Right. We are now on chapter 26 of Swamiji's commentary. It's called The Field of Battle, and it's chapter 13 of the Gita. And I'll start by reading the stanzas from the Gita itself, and then we'll go on to the commentary. Swamiji points out, interestingly, that this is one unnumbered verse, stanza, so that the total number of verses in the Gita will be around an even 700. So they had to cheat a little bit to make it happen. So they call this one the preamble, the chapter 13, and I'm sure there's some reason for it. But Arjuna said, O Keshava, Krishna, I long to know the mystery of Prakriti and Purusha, intelligent Mother Nature and transcendent God, the Father, of Kshetra, the body, and Kshetragya, the inner perceiver of knowledge and its object, that which is known. 13.1, the Blessed Lord replied, O son of Kunti, Arjuna, those who know truth perceive this human body as Kshetra, the field, where good and evil karma are reaped, and the knower of the field, the soul, as Kshetragya. Know me also, O Bharata, Arjuna, as the silent knower, perceiver in all Kshetras, bodies evolved out of the cosmic creative principle in nature. I consider true wisdom to be the understanding of Kshetra, the field, and of its relation to Kshetragya, the perceiver of the field. Hear now briefly about the field, its attributes, its cause and effect principle, and its distorting influences. Also what he, the Kshetragya, is, and the nature of his powers. Truths which have been sung by sages in many ways, in chants of the Vedas, and in well-reasoned, conclusive aphorisms of the Brahma Sutra. Succinctly stated, quoting scripture, the Kshetras are composed of both undifferentiated and differentiated nature, their differentiated nature being the gross elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, the 10 senses, the 5 organs of knowledge, the ears, skin, eyes, nose, and tongue, and the 5 objects of sense, hearing, feeling, sight, smell, and taste, and the 5 organs of action, the hands, feet, mouth, anus, and generative organ, and the 1 sense conscious mind, intellect, ego consciousness, the distortions of citta, attraction, aversion, pleasure, pain, the body itself, consciousness, and persistence. The true insight bestowed by wisdom is revealed in the following qualities: humility, unpretentiousness, harmlessness, forgiveness, integrity, service to the guru, purity of mind and body, steadfastness, self-control, indifference to sense objects, lack of emphasis on one's own self, perception of the sufferings and evils inherent in birth, illness, old age, and death, non-attachment, non-identification of the ego with one's own children, wife, and home, and with everything that these entail, equal acceptance of both fortune and misfortune, unswerving devotion to and identity with me through yoga practice, love of solitude, disinclination for worldly society, perseverance in the pursuit of self-knowledge, aspiration toward true wisdom, which is the goal of all learning. Qualities that oppose these virtues are the signs of ignorance. I will now tell you what knowledge one should pursue, true knowledge, which bestows immortality. Hear what I have to say about the supreme, beginningless Brahman, he who cannot be said either to exist or not to exist, since existence implies coming into being. He dwells, however, omnipresent in the universe, pervading all, heads, eyes, ears, faces, everywhere, shining in all the sense faculties, yet transcending them, the mainstay of everything, yet attached to nothing, above the 3 gunas, qualities, yet experiencing everything through them, within and without all that exists, both animate and inanimate, the nearest of the near, yet so subtle as to be imperceptible. He, the indivisible one, appears divided into countless beings, maintaining, then destroying their forms, then manifesting them anew. The light of lights he is, beyond all darkness, all knowledge, whether knowable or aspired to, he is forever seated in the hearts of all. I have briefly described here the field, Kshetra, the nature of wisdom, and the object of wisdom. Possessed of this insight, my devotee enters into me. Okay. Well, there you have it. We're not quite sure what we have, but there you have it. Some chapters are easier to understand than others, don't you think? Any questions or comments or thoughts from anything from last week or this before we launch into it? One of the, just right at the beginning of this commentary, Swamiji writes that this combination of the sequence of the chapters here, last week we were talking about devotion and the supreme power of simply loving God and how everything just comes down in the end to loving God. And right here, Swami writes that he thinks that the reason Arjuna asks these questions next is so that, as he puts it, people might otherwise seek a shortcut through devotion and end up becoming superficial in their spiritual search, not fully understanding that the battle is still necessary. Now, it's sort of an interesting comment, and this whole question of the Bhagavad Gita, the whole story of the Bhagavad Gita, in the context of the Mahabharata, in the context of it all beginning with Arjuna saying that he didn't want to fight. Here he is on the field of Kurukshetra, which here is being specifically really made clear that what we're really talking about is the battlefield within our own selves, of our own consciousness. Arjuna represents the third chakra, and the third chakra is the will, which must be engaged. And the third chakra controls the lower chakras and determines the direction of that energy. And if Arjuna, if our own willpower, determines that it's not going to be engaged in the battle, then the battle simply doesn't happen. That's why even though there's five Pandava brothers, everything depends on whether Arjuna fights or not, because the upper chakras can't go advance without the cooperation of the personal willpower, which is what the third chakra, which Arjuna represents. So his unwillingness to fight is a point that every devotee reaches on the spiritual path, where you can be on the spiritual path for a long time in just a kind of happy way. Isn't it beautiful? Don't we all just love God? You know, isn't it lovely how God takes care of us? Don't we just love to sing and chant? And aren't we nice to one another? And you know, isn't God is so good to us because we love him? You know, just sort of all the things that you do. I personally actually felt that when I first came to Ananda Village at the age of 24, and really for until 1990, that was from 1971 almost to 1990. That was a pretty long time, especially the first 16 years, which I lived at Ananda Village. We were extremely poor financially. We lived in very, very humble circumstances. We had nothing extra to spend. It was a very simple life, and it was probably the closest thing to heaven on earth I think I will ever experience in my life. We were just out in the woods with Swamiji and all our brothers and sisters. We were building this little ashram. We had a vague idea of where we were going, but not a real clear one. And I don't know, everything was just delightful. It doesn't mean that there weren't personal struggles. There were. But the whole context was almost unreal in its spiritual perfection. It's the only way I could describe it.
And now here we are in this.
Well, that's not the problem. What happened in between was that SRF sued Ananda. And then we had 12 years of litigation in which we were forced collectively to recognize that the powers of light are always opposed by the powers of darkness, and merely being nice and sweet isn't enough to guarantee victory in this life, and that there are forces in this world that actively work to to counter upward moving energy. And during those 12 years, it got extremely ugly before it was over. And in the end, it all, you know, you win, we won some, we lost some. Didn't really make any difference because spiritually speaking, it was all victorious. We learned that justice doesn't necessarily happen in a court of law. We learned a lot of things we needed to learn. And we came out the other side as grown-ups, not as children. You know, I mean, we weren't children. I was in my 30s, though probably 40 years old when it started. But I was a child in my naivete about what the spiritual path would be like. I thought it would just be just me and my good buddies and we'd just have lots of fun. I never thought we'd have to confront, do battle. That's the actual word. That's the only word I can think of. And actually, it was really a Kurukshetra kind of scene because we were fighting our own Gurubhais. Some people even who had been close to us within Ananda, it fractured, never fractured the center of Ananda, but it chipped edges off. And so people that we knew well were suddenly very strongly opposed to us. There was an extraordinary amount of dishonesty. We had to meet people who were not nice, who lied as a matter of course and things like that. It's a long and I find it extremely interesting story, but I don't want to go too far into it. But I just want to use it as an example. Now, probably all of you, whether or not your experience was collective, as my story is in this way, and I know many of you were involved in that collective story of Ananda also, and for many of you, perhaps not quite as vividly as I, because I was more in the center of it, it was really the watershed moment, which is, am I willing to be on the spiritual path, even if it turns into essentially war? You know, or am I only in it if we can just be nice? And there was a tremendous crisis within Ananda when all of that started about whether or not it was appropriate for devotees to do battle. It was a complete repetition of the story of the Mahabharata. We were, in fact, at war with our cousins for the right to be disciples of Master. We were fighting for the divine kingdom, and we had to be very, very fierce against people that we would normally have considered our allies. Just exactly as Arjuna, as the Pandavas were forced to fight with the Kauravas, and Krishna was urging him to fight, and we certainly felt Master was urging us to fight. It was a very complex situation. But the end point of it was, we were prevented from what Swami says here, becoming superficial in our spiritual path. Because we had to actually see, because this wasn't centuries ago, you know, centuries ago when these fights took place, it was usually the Catholic Church against renegade monks, and you would be imprisoned, you know, or beaten. St. John of the Cross was just thrown into prison. Many great saints were, Joan of Arc was burned at the stake. You know, many really bad things happened to some really good people, and it generally they were persecuted by the Christian Church. The Catholic Church, which had enough power and the age was harsh enough, Jesus himself was crucified. That was a pretty lowly end for someone of such noble character. So we used to comfort ourselves with the fact that even though we were trapped in a courtroom, at least we could go home at night and sleep in our own beds and have whatever meals we wanted, and no one could actually raise a physical hand to us. They could empty our bank accounts, that was true. And in theory, conceivably, eventually confiscate our property, which never happened. But our persons, at least, were safe from violation, and we would actually think, you know, what if our persons were actually on the line too? Would we have the courage still to stand up and fight? Now, sometimes in the life of a devotee, it actually comes to that. It actually comes to a question of life or death, or reputation, or public opinion, or having to do that which you would not be temperamentally inclined to do, but you're forced by circumstances to pick up a sword and fight a battle, just as Arjuna was, for the sake of your cause, and you really cannot see any other honorable option, just as Arjuna was finding himself, and just superficial devotion is not sufficient. Now, what Arjuna is introducing here also is he's simply introducing the concept of how far we have to go to really be on the spiritual path. And this is, as I've mentioned several times, Swami writes about this too. The Bhagavad Gita and the whole tradition of Sanatana Dharma, which is commonly called Hinduism, but Hinduism isn't really the whole of Sanatana Dharma at all, is the only religion in the world that actively has moksha, total divine freedom, as the goal. You know, in the Christian religion, you're saved and you get to go to heaven. You get to sort of be there with the angels. And the really good news about Christianity is that you don't have to go to hell. I mean, heaven is nice, but what's really great is that you're not going to hell. But it doesn't talk about, it's just essentially a happy place where the ego goes and gets, where the ego finally gets fulfilled. That's really what most religious, institutional religions' concept of success on the spiritual path is. You go somewhere where the ego actually does get to be fulfilled. You get comfort, you get beauty, and some of the religions are really gross. You get, you know, women if you're a man, you get wine, you get all these things that you think that you want will give you fulfillment. But the Bhagavad Gita, especially in this chapter, describes it as in a very, very different context. That actual victory on this spiritual path is that you understand and transcend the desire for those things. And this is why it's not such a popular path. I mean, it's a much more popular path to be able to have everything that you want and then call it spiritual. And that's a great deal of what is passing for, quote, New Age religion these days, is just, oh, well, we'll teach you to be rich, we'll teach you to have wonderful relationships, we'll teach you to have, you know, fabulous sex life until you're 99. You know, these are all like, and these are considered to be the great fruits of your spiritual practice, as someone said who came to our church briefly. Many people talk about overcoming the ego, but you all actually mean it. You know, it's like overcoming the ego is often sort of code for fulfilling it. So what we talk about here, the way Swami describes it, the true war of Kurukshetra, is the struggle between upward aspiration, which causes the energy in the body to flow upward, and the downward pull toward lower awareness, which brings man's expectations of fulfillment outward to the senses. The mere things he hopes to enjoy are themselves inanimate and can never satisfy him in any way except in his own reactions to them. What defines the downward direction as being evil is that, in its outwardness from the inner source, it disappoints what everyone in samsara, in maya, really wants, which is ego fulfillment, emotional happiness, and the enjoyment of life through the senses. It takes man also in the direction opposite to what he wants ultimately, which is divine bliss. And then he goes on to say, it's so fun, were it possible for human nature truly to be fulfilled outwardly, we'd be fools not to do it. But that's the fundamental problem. Now, that is the hardest thing to really grasp. And I love the way Swami puts it. He puts it so the battle is within us, and the battle actually is taking place in the spine with the upward moving energy that essentially wants all of our concentration to be directed upward toward the spiritual eye, or the downward and outward moving energy, which imagines that which we seek will be fulfilled through our involvement in the physical world that we perceive through the senses. Now, it's very easy to talk about these things, but it's very complex to actually live through this. Because at the same time, it's not as if we can simply deny the existence of this world or deny these desires or win, as we sometimes say, by merely suppressing those desires. In fact, directly in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna uses this phrase, of what avail suppression? It really won't give us anything merely to withhold. And then there's long discussions about how you cannot achieve the actionless state, which is to have transcended the inclination to be outward, by merely doing nothing. Because doing nothing is an act of restraining that outward direction. And then therefore we haven't transcended it, we have merely restrained it. What we have to do is actually overcome the inclination even to seek that direction for our fulfillment. And yet at the same time, even later in this chapter when Krishna is describing what the man of wisdom looks like, he says he holds without attachment family, home, wife, children, and all that comes, without ego involvement. And in Autobiography of a Yogi, Master actually says that the householder path, provided the devotee can participate without ego involvement is actually a higher path than the path of outward renunciation. Of course, there's that little phrase, provided he can participate without egoic involvement. Because sometimes the compelling force of all this karma simply has to be lived through. So it's not a question of refusing to do it. It's doing it from the right understanding. And then there is the obvious thought that if we're not seeking fulfillment in it, if we've understood that it won't bring us what we're seeking, then why would we participate and how do we participate? And tremendous misunderstandings begin to evolve in terms of people being cold. You know, that was a great difficulty at the beginning of Ananda, that in the name of being detached, people actually became unfeeling. And even in intimate family relationships, people were cold to one another out of fear, quote, of becoming attached. I remember someone once scolding someone else because the newly married couple, the husband had gone off for a trip and the wife was lamenting that she really missed him. And someone said, oh, you better be careful, you're going to become attached. And the woman honestly answered, she says, of course I'm attached. I never would have married him if I wasn't attached to him. You know, what would be the point? It's not a question of just spouting aphorisms. It actually has to be a living through the force of our own nature, but seeing what is really behind it. And that's why so often in these verses, Krishna will say, in such and so, I am there. Behind this, I am there. Behind that, I am there. In this situation, I am there. Because it's in actually engaging in this reality and then seeing it from a higher level that our freedom actually comes from. Otherwise, we live, this suppression comes. Suppression is, just involves some level of fear of involvement. And even actually the deeply held belief that that will actually bring us fulfillment, but a fear of going in that direction. You know, this is Swami's phrase, many people are not really actually as good as they appear, they just either lack the courage or the energy to sin. Their inner desires are really massively outward, but they're afraid of going to hell. Going to hell was a marvelous, the threat of going to hell was a marvelous way for people to control their outer behavior. I mean, if you really thought that you were going to spend an eternity in hell if you gave in to certain desires, it was a really powerful incentive not to. But it wasn't really necessarily, it didn't necessarily lead to any kind of transcendence. It may have led to restraint, but it didn't necessarily lead to freedom. And see, this is the difference between a teaching where you're actually trying to become free as opposed to one where you're trying to just behave so you can get the right reward. And so it's a huge difference. So the breaking apart, which is what we have been privileged to experience in our particular lifetime, of all moral standards and all sort of restraint on human impulses, is not so pleasant to live through necessarily, but in fact, it's forward. It's a forward motion. Because the force of society and the condemning power of the religious institutions was sufficient to hold those lesser impulses in check, it didn't necessarily mean that the people were advancing spiritually. It just meant that they weren't allowed to follow through. And what also happens in that condition is that it makes a more stable society, perhaps, who knows. But but individuals simply wait for the opportunity to find out for themselves what's true. So the advantage of what we're living through now is that any individual who desires any kind of experience, basically on any level of depravity, outwardness, however you want to call it, can find it and do it. Things that used to be just shocking, you know, that would cause you to be ostracized from society are just simply written up in People magazine. Just doesn't mean anything to anybody now. We idolize the most immoral. It's really quite a remarkable time to live in. Yeah, and what used to be considered pornographic is now family time television. I mean, it's the most bizarre. It's really bizarre. I was in the emergency room with my mother once. And And we were going for a checkup. She wasn't in a tough state. It was her insistence that we were there. We didn't really need to be there. So I was just sitting there. There was a big television playing, and I was watching some kind of I don't know if it was supposed to be a comedy or not. I don't know what it was. The humor was all about, you know, the man trying to have an adulterous affair with the woman, and the point of the joke was that she wouldn't do it. Everybody just in the whole sitcom thought that was so hilarious that she was actually had some sense of moral restraint. That was the whole joke. I'm just watching it like this. You know, I don't know what it was. I'd never seen anything like it. My mother turns to me and she says, "You're behaving as if you were just dropped in here from another planet." I said, "I think I was. I think it's the truth." You know, it's just, now, but the good news of that is that whatever we know, we actually know. That's far better. Because until, as Master said, it's not enough, as he put it, to be good merely because it is our habit to be good. Good meaning that our energy moves in the direction of our ultimate happiness. We have to move in the direction of our ultimate happiness because we have no desire to move in any other direction. It's not enough. I mean, first it's a habit, first it's an affirmation, but eventually it has to just become the natural inclination of our energy, that there is no inclination. Just as, if you look at your lives, I mean, there's so many downward moving possibilities of energy that we're simply not inclined toward, you know? Drinking, carousing around in certain ways. Just there's lots of very outward and downward movements of energy that it takes no discipline to not do them. They simply hold no attractiveness to us. And in the same way, in Autobiography of a Yogi, there's the conversation between Bhaduri Mahashaya and one of his devotees. And he had been a very wealthy man. And the man, one of the devotees, said, "I understand you renounce great wealth to become a yogi, and what a renunciate you are." And he said, it's the worldly man who is the true renunciate. He sacrifices an infinity of bliss for a handful of rupees. You know, and that was just how it looked to him. It wasn't anything at all. I remember Swamiji. It was very interesting. A few years ago, he gave a satsang, and he was telling us, it was an interesting question because we have two devotee orders, sort of in inner circles, so to speak, within the greater circle of Ananda Sangha. One is called the Sadhaka order and one is called the Sevaka order. The Sadhaka order is essentially, householder is not the right word, but it's a lay order, and the Sevaka order is a monastic order. Now, neither of them are celibate orders and neither of them preclude marriage, but the Sevaka order is people who have the karmic freedom to essentially what we call be in the army, which is that we have no inhibiting conditions in our lives that prevent us from doing whatever is needed to serve this work. And of course, that's a certain level of dedication, but it also represents a certain karmic freedom. The sadhaka order, which is just outside of that, may be people who are equally dedicated inwardly, but for one reason or another, their karmic circumstances don't give them that same freedom. Perhaps they are married to someone who's not supportive. Perhaps they have a parallel destiny in some kind of a career. Perhaps just within themselves, they know that they really don't want to surrender their self-determination to that extent. There can be lots of reasons. So this is all by way of introduction, that Swamiji was giving a satsang, and he was giving a satsang for the sadhaka order, the karmically slightly more limited condition than the monastic order, the lay order. And someone had asked him to explain what it meant to be in the lay order. Now, much to our puzzlement, Swamiji begins to describe his own life of renunciation. And he talks about many different things, and it culminated, and I remember him talking about this. When he had been in the SRF monastery for 14 years, and then in 1962 he was expelled from that organization, which was the key to all the lawsuits that I was talking about before, because when he was expelled, he was supposed to disappear. And when he didn't disappear and founded what is essentially the second church of self-realization, the first church of self-realization said, no, we own all these teachings. There can't be a second church. You know, throughout the history of churches in America, the first church almost always in one way or another sues the second church in one form or another. And the second church is always founded by some ex-member of the first church who wasn't supposed to be able to do that. And then there's a fight. If it hadn't happened 100 times in the past, we might take it personally. But anyway, so in 1962, at the age of 36, Swami Kriyananda finds himself suddenly expelled, rejected entirely from the only life he's ever known. And he's been a monastic. He's lived in a monastery since he was 22. He doesn't know, you know, really any, he has no position, nothing. He's penniless and friendless. All his friends were taken away from him. He ends up at his parents' house, living in, you know, their back bedroom, all alone, trying to figure out what to do with his life. And so gradually, he begins to resurrect it. And at a certain point, it became obvious to him that in order to have a life outside of a monastery, he was going to have a car, because you can't get around in this society without having a car. So his parents had a car that they wanted to give to him. And because they were giving it to him, they wanted him to register it in his own name. And I recall Swami looking at us, and his eyes filled with tears. He said, I can't explain to you how intensely painful it was for me when I realized I was going to have to own a car. He said, I had just renounced everything, and now I was going to own something as expensive as a car. And, you know, of course, we're all just sitting there thinking, you know, like, car, you just start with a car. You just get the pink slip. You don't even think about it. You pick out your lovely car, you own it, and here he's in tears. And he says again, I can't understand what that meant to me. So he's telling us about how to be in the lay order, and this is what he's telling us. So at some point, someone says, essentially, excuse me, sir, would you tell us what it means to be in the lay order? And very, very seriously, he says, that's all I've been talking about. And then he says, don't even try to live the way I'm living. He said, you have to live sincerely from the reality of your own consciousness. It was an amazing way to come back to that, isn't it? He set up the contrast for us of what it genuinely feels like when it's appropriate for you to live as he lives. And if it's not a genuine experience, then just live comfortably within the reality that's really ours and do our best to be even-minded and detached in the circumstances that God has given us. There's always this tremendous longing that I've observed, which is somehow there's this inner thought that somebody else's karma would be easier than mine. So I'll just work out somebody else's karma. In other words, I will create some false idea of what I'm supposed to do, and then I'll try to do that, because it'll be easier. We used to see this especially in the early days of Ananda Village, when back in the heaven on earth days that I was talking about, when we got to play out a lot of our fantasies a lot more. We were living on this big piece of land. We essentially were our own society within this. We had some, but very little interaction with the outside world. I don't mean that we were walled in or anything like that, but we were just creating our own society. And we were all relatively new to the spiritual path, so there wasn't much maturity, except from Swamiji, and he was brilliant about letting us just discover the truth on our own. So there was a lot of, there was one woman who always wore white and always carried one of Master's books. When you would speak to her, she would tend to sort of look off like that, and then she would open the book like this. There was another one who was very similar to her, and one of them actually had it's not funny, but she actually had a complete nervous breakdown and just, you know, ran naked through the fields. After that, she was much more interesting. Because she just really stopped suppressing her true nature and just started, as Swamiji puts it, our sainthood is created from the substance of the consciousness we have. It isn't anything we can impose upon us. We live on the field of Kurukshetra, and we have these downward pulling energies, and we have these aspiring energies, and we have to fight the actual battle that's taking place. We can't fight a false battle that we create over here. You know, that's why people become fanatical about diet and things like that, because it's an easier battle to fight than the actual battle of our real karma. Because our real karma is usually quite embarrassing, and it usually makes us far less perfect than we hope we are. So what we have to work with is we have to work on two levels. We have to work, Swamiji gave a satsang here once that it was not so long ago. And he was saying, you know, if you can't always feel inspired by the idea of divine fulfillment, then keep always foremost in your mind how unhappy you were before you got on the path. And he didn't mean that you should concentrate on unhappiness, but don't ever forget that the alternative is worse. And that's why one of the most moving to me passages in the Bible is at the end of Jesus' life, when he was weaning out the weak devotees, because he knew he was about to be crucified. He knew that it was going to become very, very challenging to be a follower of Jesus, and he needed a core that was strong. Apparently, Swamiji said at the end of Master's life, he was doing the same thing. While the Master is present in the body, he can sort of carry a lot of people who don't have very much inner power, but he can move them along a certain distance as long as he's present. But after he passes, especially if there's a work that has to be done, often the Master will essentially let those disciples go. I mean, not cosmically, but just let them sort of go into doing something else for the rest of this incarnation so that there'll be a powerful, a strong core. And so at the end of Jesus's life, he started making it very hard for his disciples, and that's where in the Bible it says he started saying, "Eat my body and drink my blood." And there was no footnote from the Catholic Church to tell you that that was symbolic. It was just Jesus, this young rabbi, for whom all these people had been following, who begins to give them a teaching that is completely confusing and incomprehensible to them. And you get that from the Bible, because in the Bible it says, the disciples said one to another, "This is a hard teaching." You know, they themselves were confused. It would be as if Swamiji, or if we were with Master, and Master at the end of his life did make it hard for people, or if Swamiji just stood and started asking us to do things that we just didn't understand. You know, if we didn't have the intuition to understand that the words didn't make sense. So it says, the disciples said one to another, "This is a very hard teaching." And then it says, from that point many walked with him no more. So then Jesus turns to Peter, and he says to Peter, "Will you also leave me?" And the way the Bible presents it, it wasn't as if the question had a real answer. I mean, but the guru turns to the disciple and basically says, "Where do you stand? All these other people are defecting. Where do you stand?" It's wonderful to project yourself into that situation and imagine that it has become very confusing and many people are defecting. Well, how about 1990 when we were involved in all those lawsuits, and then when we were accused of being a complete sham organization and abusive toward women and all this sexual depravity? And I mean, it was a story. It was a real story. And, you know, we were asking one to another, "Are you going to also leave? What do you know? What do you think?" People would come to me and want me to defend this work, and I said, "What do you think?" You know, I wasn't going to do it. Because if I just persuade you, I say, "What have you experienced? What do you think? Do you think these accusations could be true?" Because you see, the test, and this is in the, for Jesus too, is the same thing. The test was not whether Jesus was a true master. I mean, why would that have to be tested? He knew he was a true master. What difference did it make? He was self-realized. He was going unto the Father. What difference did it make? The test was whether the disciples had faith in their own experience. Because they had experienced Jesus' consciousness, and now he was not cooperating with their preconceptions of how he should behave. And so they were thrown back upon their own intuitive understanding, because he was confounding the convenience of their rational mind, because that was what was required. They had to have that strong intuitive strength, because he was about to be arrested and crucified as a criminal. And they were all about to be denounced by their own community. I mean, it was the Romans who actually put him to death, but unfortunately, it was their fellow Jews who convicted him, who insisted upon it. So their own community was going to turn on them and say, "He's nothing but a scoundrel." And so the devotees had to have something that was not external. They had to have it from inside themselves. You know, and all that desire for ego fulfillment, to be recognized by society, to be safe, to be confirmed by everyone else, all that downward moving energy had to be countered by this knowledge. And it was epitomized by Peter when Jesus said, "Will you also leave me?" And Peter answered perfectly, "Where would I go?" Now, what he was saying by that answer was not, "Oh, I have a perfect understanding. I know that you're speaking symbolically and that the wine is actually the blood that you're speaking of, and that represents the omnipresent consciousness of Om," and, you know, all the things that were really meant by that. He didn't say any of that. He just said, "You're mine. This is where I belong. This is who I am. There's no other reality for me." And that's enough. That's much stronger than all this rational, you know, sort of figuring it out. It's just, "This is mine. What can I do? Accept this. Where could I go? Where in creation could I possibly go? I'm right where I'm meant to be." And then Jesus said to him, that's when he named him Peter, "You are a rock. And upon this rock I will build my church," which by that he meant the church of inner realization. He did not mean the Catholic Church. They added all that later. But what they meant was, you have the necessary intuitive understanding. And for us, and that was also the experience that we had when so many people in the world, including finally a jury of our peers in a court, adjudged us terrible, because justice does not happen inside of a courtroom. We all learned, much to our great surprise, "Oh, it's not Perry Mason. What a shock." I mean, and really it was. We just didn't know that. If we had known that when we started, we might not have lost that part of the case. But we were so shocked that absolute injustice could be carried out. We just didn't know it. We're so naive. That's what I mean about being children. But then it was like, Jesus was crucified. Who cares? You know, where does my understanding come from? Now, that's a tremendous outward example. But everything that we do must come from that kind of inner understanding. This is the battle of Kurukshetra. I meditate because I know that's what I ought to do. Because of other things he says, I recognize the inherent suffering in, you know, birth, death, and life. I recognize that as long as I'm outwardly oriented, I'm doomed to at least suffer. That what I really seek, inward bliss, will not come to me. Why am I a disciple? Why am I a vegetarian? Why am I restrained in my habits? Why do I pay attention to the music I listen to? Why am I faithful to my wife? You know, any of these questions, you have to have answers that are the actual experience of upward moving energy versus downward moving energy. And it's not always easy. I remember when I was very young on the path, I was really caught up in this maelstrom of wrong thoughts and wrong desires. I was so caught up in it that every morning when I would meditate, I'd have to say to Master, "Master, if you give me a chance to do the wrong thing, I am going to take it." So the only hope is that you have to protect me. And later on, I'm going to try to talk you out of protecting me, but you need to remember that in this moment of clarity, I know what I want. And then darned if all day long he just wouldn't keep me out of trouble. No matter how hard I would try to connive, he would always keep me out of trouble. And then I'd make it back, you know, essentially back to my meditation, say, "Phew, one more day, I made it through." But I was honest enough to know that I was divided in my loyalties between what I knew to be right and what, you know, the temptations of the moment, we all are. And when we fall into those temptations, however, you know, massive or small, it's just a question of degree. That's why often very saintly people take so seriously such small transgressions, and looking at it from the outside, you think they're awfully extreme. You know, there's a story of St. Francis who was tempted. I don't know whether he was tempted by lust or what he was tempted by, but in sheer frustration, he threw himself into a patch of brambles or a wild rose bush. I think they have the picture, they have the rose bush still where Francis threw himself. Just the other day, just a couple of days ago, I parked my car near the entrance of our community, and I was sort of rushing around, I wasn't being very conscious, and I opened the door of my car, and I didn't really realize that it had opened into the rose bushes, and they're big, they're old vines, and then I put my hand out to close it, and I just stuck my hand right into those rose bushes. Mamma mia, it hurt. It was just a terrible pain. And I thought to myself, boy, Francis threw himself into these rose bushes. And I said, well, that would take his mind off other things. I'll definitely say that. But you know, it seems so extreme. But it isn't really. When you're inside of it and you realize that this is a life or death struggle, and you really want to win that battle, and you're fighting your own self. You're fighting your own inclinations, and you don't want to go there. And sometimes, as I was also starting to say, you know, on the white sheet of a very pure consciousness, some little transgression looks very, very large. And in relatively speaking, it can be. That's why the masters are so attentive. Swamiji told us a story this last weekend that he's told before, but it was so sweet. He talked about Master was in Encinitas, I guess, or San Diego, and he was up in Mount Washington in Los Angeles, and he hadn't seen Master for several weeks, and he just developed this deep longing to see Master. So he got on a bus and just went down to the other ashram where Master was, and as soon as he got there, Master came out to meet him, and Master said, I have missed you. And Swami was speaking of this in terms of, you know, who else can be so sensitive to the nuances of inner feeling as to be aware of that, aware of the refinement of Swamiji's longing to see his guru. But then Swami goes on to say that that evening, some of the monks in the ashram there where he was staying were being a little bit too frivolous in an external way. And Swami didn't talk in detail, but they were just chatting about worldly things. And Swami's mind was drawn away from his inner connectedness to Master because he got involved in these outward things. And the next day when Master saw him, Master, I think, sort of rumpled his hair and said, I have missed you. Now, you know, in an ordinary context, you wouldn't even know about such a thing. But when you become really attuned to the inner and upper and up and down flow of energy, you feel those little things and you feel them as intensely painful. That's why often, you know, great saints go through these intensely painful periods that are totally obscure to the outsider, where they have this great agony over their relationship with the infinite. And people, worldly people, are inclined to minimize them, but you're not living inside that consciousness. We haven't experienced the overwhelming sweetness of real attunement, and therefore we haven't experienced the intense suffering of even the smallest diminution of that. We're so caught up in so many levels of worldly life that we just haven't even begun to touch that. That's why Swami said to that lay order group, don't even think of trying to live like me. It wouldn't be sincere. It wouldn't be a spontaneous outpouring of your actual consciousness. It would be an affectation. And then later on, it would just collapse and cause you endless grief. You know, isn't it it's an amazing journey we're on, isn't it? Let's take a short break here, okay? Master talks in here, Swamiji talks in here about this same chapter. He talks about the fact that the habit and desire, he says, separate one from soul awareness. Added to that initial separation is the fierce hold the ego exerts on his awareness and the host of negative qualities that develop from ego consciousness and that cause him suffering. They wrap themselves around his ego. And then he uses the image of Gulliver being bound up by all those little threads, by the Lilliputians, and ending up just being bound by 100,000 tiny little strings, none of which could have held him. I love that thought, habit and desire. When I was teaching a Meditation 1 class, and I have a room full of people who are trying to meditate almost all for the very first time, you know, the question arises, why is it so hard to meditate? I mean, or why, let's phrase it differently, why can't I just close my eyes and meditate if it's so natural to me? And the answer I put on the board was the word habit. Because we have this profound habit of seeing reality from the outside. And it's a very interesting, just kind of everyday meditative practice to ask yourself, you know, where is my consciousness centered? Am I really living from a deeply held belief that my inner reality is the first reality? Or am I constantly living as if the outer reality, as if my happiness and comfort depended on things outside myself? And this is the daily practice of overcoming, you know, ego involvement, ego attachment. It's not that you don't participate with full commitment and attention in the world that's around you. It's a question of, where do I think my fulfillment is coming from? And then once we have the thought in our mind, this habit and desire, let me just think of what I was saying there, is like the habit of experiencing life through what our body experiences and what we see, taking our evidence from what's happening around us instead of taking our evidence from an inner intuition. You know, that's the strong habit we have. All our energy moves outward. So we sit quietly to meditate. We cut off sensory input. We cease moving our body. We cease satisfying the usual senses in any particular way. And all of a sudden, we can't just suddenly turn that river back. The river's been moving in that direction so much of the time, there's a kind of feeling like you've got a monkey in a cage. And then you add to that that we're not passive about that outer relationship. We have a desire to be engaged because we have this deep, though false, idea that we can actually find ultimate fulfillment through all those realities. And it's such a subtle sort of thought that it's one that we just have to work with and work with and work with. And this is where very simple, well, later on, he gives us all these qualities, you know, humility, unpretentiousness, harmlessness, forgiveness. What are the characteristics of all of these? All of these have to do with seeing our happiness is coming from our inner state of consciousness and not so much from our imposing ourselves upon the world. You know, we get this thought of, and he talks here too about how the ego binds us, all the things that come with it. Oh, I really was impressive in that meeting, wasn't I? I really did a good job there. I think those people are really going to like me. Wow, if I make that big sale, you know, then I'm going to be able to get that new car. And when I drive around in that new car, aren't I going to look really spiffy? And aren't the girls going to think that I'm really nice? And then, you know, my father, who never really thought I would succeed, is really going to have to respect, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And all of these are thoughts, you know, that are spun from this habit of thinking, if I can just make it work in a certain way. And then, of course, the corollary of that is when those things don't happen, if they don't happen in exactly the way that we think they should, then we have all this sense of anxiety. And then the whole thing goes backwards. Oh, well, now I guess I'm a failure, and now, you know, what they said about me is going to be true, and I'm never going to be able to impress everyone, and it all goes backwards, and it's this endless sort of cycle. And the worst of it is, it's not merely that it ultimately disappoints you in the end. It's that even when you succeed, it turns into nothing much. As it says here, the object of the senses are inanimate, and they can't in themselves give you joy. Many of you were here a few years ago when we were living in a different apartment, and we decided to put a new carpet in, and we made the whole house in these shades of gold and yellow, which we still have. And we wanted to get a carpet of a certain sort of golden color, which turned out to be extremely difficult to find. And so for many days, we were going through this huge saga of getting this carpet, and then we finally got it, and we figured out we could get it cheaper, and we had it shipped, and we moved it, and we finally laid it in the house, and then there it was, you know, the golden colored carpet throughout the whole house. And I just remember walking in, and, well, there it was, you know? And I sort of bent down and tried really hard to have it make me happy. But it was an inanimate object. And it didn't have any capacity to actually generate any love back to me. That's what I felt. This carpet cannot love me. It does not have the equipment to love me. I can project love on it, but it can't love me. And how many of the things that we're sort of projecting all this energy toward can actually love us back? And so, and even our fellow human beings, even if we're gifted with wonderful children and wonderful relatives, you know, there's still even that point where someone loves you completely as they can, but there's still, you find this deep sense of inner longing. He says it here, how does he put the word? That we always remember the soul. We never forget that our actual nature is infinite. And so no matter how much we are able to obtain from the experiences that we get through attachment to this body and the ego that follows, We always have a point of comparison. Even if it's deeply buried in our consciousness and we're not completely aware of it, we always have a point of comparison. And it's that the complete inherent inability of the downward and outwardly moving energy to give us the satisfaction we remember in our soul nature is what really causes the deepest unhappiness, which is why, they say, there's more suicides among wealthy people than there are among poor people. It's an interesting statement, isn't it? Because wealthy people have gathered, they have everything they're supposed to have to make them happy. And then imagine the despair. You see, if you're poor or aspiring or working hard, you can always imagine that if I just get this, then I'll be okay. But how much worse is it when you actually have it? I mean, that's, you know, nobody who, was it Mae West, who said, I've been rich and I've been poor and I tell you, honey, rich is better. You know, that's sort of the worldly wisdom. And, you know, it can be more convenient. And ultimately, and this is the most interesting thing about it, ultimately you have to have all those desires fulfilled. Because as long as there is anything that you imagine that will make you happy, you will not be willing to renounce it. You will not be willing to turn away from it, because you will always imagine that it will make you happy. That's just the way it is. And until, that's why Swami put it so simply, we learn from being disappointed, but we learn more from being fulfilled. And that's why it doesn't serve to just stand back. That's why if you really desire something, you need to do it. We've just published a little book of Master's teachings, How to Be a Success. And it's just unequivocal. It's a fabulous book. I've just started reading it, but just the first few pages, it's, you know, you if you want to accomplish something, never give up. He doesn't talk about just be detached. It's all a dream anyway. If you want it, never give up. I was talking about that earlier, about it's the act of pursuing excellence and eventually succeeding that causes us to overcome the limiting conditions of our own consciousness. That was the subject of a class a couple of weeks ago. But the other side of it is, if you want it, you will never be at peace until you have it. As long as you imagine, it will fulfill you. And so you just have to keep going. You'll come back lifetime after lifetime in order to have it. And that's why our desires are not evil in themselves. It's the ego attachment to those desires that actually pulls us down. It's not the pursuit of them. That's why you look at, well, the avatars especially. I mean, look at Swami Kriyananda and look at a master especially, but we have Swami. He has accomplished so much in his life. You know, his example of how to be a dynamic spiritual person has not at all been to do nothing. And even there are some saints who were asked by God to do nothing. Swamiji himself tells the story of Yogi Ramya is his name, and he was a disciple of Ramana Maharshi, and he was a realized soul. Swamiji went and spent 4 days with him in India in 1958-59. And Swamiji said he lived out in this little remote village, and he had no following, seemingly hardly any or no disciples. The people in the village didn't give him any particular regard. And Swamiji said, with all your realization, you know, why haven't you done more work? And that yogi simply answered, God has done what he wanted to have done through this body. Now we also have to understand that the consciousness of such a person of realization uplifts the world more than the actions of anyone else. When Master's most advanced male disciple was Rajasi Janakananda, James J. Lin, an American, and once St. Lin, as he called him, was sitting on the bluff outside Encinitas meditating in a state of cosmic consciousness, and Master was walking nearby with someone. He should be very quiet not to disturb him. And then Master said, you have no idea the blessings that come to this work and all who are part of it when even one person meditates so deeply. So we also have to understand that merely because Yogi Ramya didn't do anything that showed externally did not mean that he wasn't emanating tremendous positive, doing great work for the world. We have to think of it in terms of the fact that at all times we are simply tuning in to different levels of vibration, that the vibrations that the masters put out, I mean, Jesus put it really simply, to all who received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. That's what Jesus said. And even now that's true, that these great masters emanate these uplifting vibrations. And when we begin to seek that upward moving energy, we get on the wavelength of these higher vibrations, which are intensified by the power of these great masters in the world, either in or out of their bodies, who are constantly emanating these vibrations. When we seek to be in tune with those vibrations, then our consciousness is inspired and lifted upward. This battle that we're fighting between the upward and downward moving energy, we have there's a lot of soldiers on the upward moving side. That Krishna was there with Arjuna. Krishna himself did not pick up a weapon and fight, but Krishna was always there guiding Arjuna. He was driving his chariot. That's the image that's used. He was driving his chariot. He was the constant witness to everything that Arjuna was doing. In other words, he was the inspiring force behind it. When Swami Kriyananda was talking about his own leadership, this is sort of an interesting story, and there's a book called Reflections on Life, on Community Life. I don't know if it's still in print or not. Nishala Crier interviewed a lot of people who'd been part of Ananda for a long time and then wrote up their stories in this little book. She did a lovely job. It's a very nice book. Two different people told stories in which they talked about Swami Kriyananda giving them an extremely difficult assignment, and then partly just to be humorous, but also partly because they felt that way. And then they said, and then he just drove off and left me to do it, or just, you know, gave me this little bit of instruction and then left me to my own. When Swami read that, he called up both those people. He said very strongly, "I never left you alone." He said, "I was always projecting my consciousness to help you." And he insisted that they change that. And then later, when he was writing himself about leadership, he was saying that the way he's been a leader is that he hasn't individually instructed David and I in all the years that we've been here. Swamiji has given us almost no specific instruction. Twice, once we were about to dissolve the ashram house before we had any place for people to live to and live in, and he called up and he said, "I really don't think that's a good idea." And once we thought people were going to give us property in Santa Cruz for a retreat, turned out they wanted to sell it to us, not give it to us, which was a world of difference. But we were thinking of having a retreat in this area. At that time, the Expanding Light was struggling to survive. And Swamiji basically said, "You know, if you start that retreat, it'll just completely kill the Expanding Light." And his actual words are, "I think we need that land like we need a hole in the head," was what he said. I said to David, "I'm picking up that he doesn't favor this plan. Are you getting that too, you know?" We sort of, "Yeah, I sense that. Do you sense it?" But it's not that we have never talked to him, but that's the only, I think even to this day, that's the only time he's ever told us what to do. And yet, we've always felt that we were always acting in accordance with his guidance. And then he described it himself when he talked about it. He said, "I project ideas into the ether, you know, thoughts about how things can be done, and those who are in tune with it will pick them up and act on it." And so if you ask me, I have the distinct impression that I'm constantly being guided by Swamiji. But when I stand back and think about it, I think, well, we've hardly talked to him about it, and he's hardly ever given us any specific instructions. I mean, we have colony leaders meetings, and we talk, but it's not anything like, "Well, do you think we should do this? Do you think we should do that?" And we showed him this church, we showed him the community, but a lot of it is you're well in motion before he even enters the picture. And I don't want to minimize the external contact, because it's always been there. But the sense of being guided is much greater than the actual external contact. And then when he wrote that, I thought, but of course, there's just this feeling of the consciousness that's with you, and you're just kind of moving in that. I mean, that's what attunement is. So we have to appreciate that Krishna's always there. And that's where God says, you know, the one who is observing, the soul observing, the guru observing, and then in the Gita, Krishna says, speaking for God, the silent observer, that's me, always watching this. And so as we move our consciousness out of that ego attachment, so even if we're acting out this life of a householder, this wife and children, this home and all that comes with it, we're really acting out just the sort of impersonal expression of the divine force going through these things. And the ego principle is that, well, this is my house, these are my children, this is my home, this is my fulfillment, this is, instead of that, just this sort of impersonal, this is happening through me, this is happening around me, this is the responsibility I have, but not such a defined sense of identification with it. And what that also means is that when, you know, fate changes, you just change course with it, because one's attachment is to the inner flow of divine guidance, not to the specific form that guidance takes. You see the difference? You know, I'm doing this because it feels right to me, or because my karma has brought me here and this is what I have to do, or because I'm moved to do this. I'm moved to write this book, write this music, take this job, marry this woman, raise these children, you know, open this business. I feel moved to do it. But it's a flow of energy going through me. It's not I who am doing it, because that's such a limiting idea. Plus, you don't want to be bound by it. You just want it to happen. But then once it has to happen, we're obligated to be the divine in that situation, which means to be the best we can. But the detachment, and then you can move so much more freely and you have so much more fun. I mean, even I was describing all those terrible lawsuits. We laughed so much, we just would laugh. I mean, we just laughed till our sides were hurting. Even in the worst of it, we were laughing. Because why not? It was just so terrible, you know, that there was really nothing you could do. And besides that, just why let it get you down? Just because God is taking you in directions that if you'd had a choice, you wouldn't have gone. Why let it get you down? What does it really have to do with you and your happiness? You see, even in the midst of that, Swamiji would say, they can take everything away from me, but they can't take away from me the only thing that matters, which is my love for God and God's love for me. And if we're always behind everything living in that, you see, then all of these qualities come out, even-minded and cheerful, alike in praise or blame, indifferent to death and life, seeing, holding all these things lightly. Because we're so strongly rooted to something that transcends it all, that you can just go through it as an actor goes through a play. This is the part I'm asked to play, and I really need to play it well. Well, among other reasons, you don't want to have to come back and do it again, right? And because you want to do it in the way it's meant to be done so you can really learn the lesson and then move on from it. Well, any questions or thoughts or comments before we call it a night? All right. Thank you all very much. And I think I've mentioned to you that one class is canceled like October something, 5th or 6th. But other than that, we're meeting continuously every Tuesday for a while. Okay, thank you all very much.